Support for today's show comes from Squarespace. With beautiful templates created by world-class designers, Squarespace makes it easy to turn your idea into a new and unique website in just a few clicks. Squarespace's analytics helps you grow in real time, and if you have a question, their award-winning 24/7 customer support is there to help. Think it, dream it, make it with Squarespace. Head to squarespace.com for a free trial, and when you're ready to launch, use the offer code MU to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain.
Welcome to Mysterious Universe, Season 18, Episode 11. Coming up on this show, we've got Encountering the Spectral Wolf Bear Dog, the Inner Earth Gold of Palette Quappy, and Black Ops Doubloons! I'm Benjamin Grundy, joining me is Aaron Wright.
Dog, bear, wolf, I think sounds better.
Bear, dog, wolf.
Yeah.
You can't have dog and wolf next to each other, because it's basically the same thing.
Well, not to the experience. Look, it's spectral, okay? So that makes it a little bit different.
Yeah, I like how you're explaining this story to me. He's trying to explain what the wolf bear dog is and how dangerous it is. And he says, well, what you've got to remember about the wolf bear dog is that it's spectral. I'm like, oh, well, that changes everything.
Oh, it does. It does. Especially when it's playing with your children in their nursery. It's terrifying.
Does that mean I need to be more scared of it or less scared of it? Because it's spectral, so it's not physical. So then how's it going to hurt me?
Yeah, that's a good point, actually. The kids couldn't pat it. It went into their room, and they were trying to pat the dog, and they were, like, patting through it.
It's really weird. The kids are trying to pat the wolf bear dog.
Yeah, it was really strange. Like, it wasn't aggressive at all.
So. I cannot wait for the content you have coming up on Plus.
I have some crazy ghost stories coming up, because we haven't done ghost stories in a while, so I picked up this really old book called Dangerous Ghosts. It was published back in 1954. Mm. And I'm thinking, oh, this is just going to have all those, this classic, oh, something moved in the house. No, it has all these really strange stories of there being amorphous blobs attacking people and strange fingerless hands grabbing people in the night. And I'm like, yep, that's perfect. That will go on Plus.
Lock it in.
Lock it in.
You ran out of Jenny Randall's books. That's what happens.
Shh. Although today, as I'm sitting there, the post guy walks in, and as he comes in, he just hands me this, you know, envelope, open it up, Jenny Randall's book.
Yeah, it was too. It was too. Well, we've got a great show coming up. It's been a difficult week for me. I had one of those weeks where every thread I was trying to pull was a dead end in a way. Mm. And it was kind of emergency stations yesterday, because on Thursdays, we record on Fridays, but on Thursdays, I like to be nice and prepared, you know, have everything planned out, all my content read ideally, and be ready to go on Friday.
I agree. But I find that when you sleep on it as well, then you're ready to go. Processed it.
You absorb it and it's in your head. And I realized it was emergency stations when yesterday the book I was reading for the show was about wine.
No, well, hang on. The book was actually pretty good. I like the idea. It's about this guy who essentially, fooled or, like, was charging 50 grand for a bottle of wine?
He fooled the world of wine connoisseurs in the United States in between 2002 and 2008. The book is called In Vino Duplicitous?
Duplicitous, yeah.
It's the rise and fall of a wine forger extraordinaire. And it was a really interesting read, but it got bogged down by all the technicalities of the wine world.
Right. And it doesn't translate well to audio.
I can't talk about Pinots and Burgundies for an hour on the show. But this guy, he turned up out of nowhere. He's a young Indonesian guy, 20 years old. And the wine connoisseur world of those really rare, super expensive wines is dominated by old men. And here comes this young Indonesian kid with a lot of passion. And he just started to work everyone in the industry and in that world. He got really tight with a bunch of people with a lot of money. He made it sound as if he had connections all over the world. And he was just really good at researching everything. So after a short amount of time, the guy sounded like an expert.
Right.
He knew everything about the wine world. And it wasn't until between those years, 2002 and 2008, he sold, it was nearly $50 million worth of wine.
Isn't that incredible?
Because there are all these rare bottles, you know, from amazing years, like 1947 from some farm in France. And one bottle will sell for 20 grand, 30 grand, 50 grand.
Yeah, it's like Grange here, that Penfolds Grange, and you can pick it up for, what, 80 grand a bottle?
And he was turning up to these wine tasting events, and he basically worked this persona. He was manipulating this persona around himself, and everyone eventually believed, because they wanted to believe, that he had this secret stash of wines that were so ultra rare, you would only read about them or hear about them. And he had these bottles and he was willing to sell them to you for a discount.
Do you know what's crazy? These are wines that people don't even drink as well. They buy them and they just keep the wine. It's gonna be like, why would you do that? At least drink it. I mean, you're going to buy an $80,000 bottle of wine, enjoy it.
Well, in the end, just to spoil everything for you, he was getting his mum to just bottle wines for him.
Because no one wants to admit that all wine tastes like cat's piss.
Yeah, that's the thing. People wanted to buy into it. They didn't want to believe that he was scamming them. So this thing just went on for years and years and years. And he was doing things like he would order a really expensive, amazing bottle at a ritzy restaurant. But then he would bribe what's the name of the wine guy?
Oh, I don't know. I should know that.
Not the waiter.
Not the maitre d' or
something like that. He would bribe that guy and make sure that the bottle would be kept for him.
Right.
With the cork.
Ah.
So that he could basically
rebottle it.
He would fill it up later and then just resell it at an auction. It was it's an insane story. And ultimately he was caught because there was this massive auction with, you know, 30 bottles of his wines. And they were this really rare wine from 1945, this French one called Ponceau Clos Saint-Denis, some red Burgundy. And it just so happened at this auction, there was a French guy there whose grandfather bottled those wines. And he sees the wines in the auction booklet and he's like, no, no, no. Grandpapa never used a cork in that year.
Oh, wow.
And the whole thing's exposed.
It all came crashing down.
Yeah.
That's incredible. Goes to show you that ultimately a lie, you'll eventually get caught out.
Yeah.
That's madness. So, okay, once you abandoned that, what did you end up coming up with for this show?
Oh, just a bunch of underground-based stuff. Just a bunch of lost cities.
That was your emergency. You cracked your emergency book open and went for it.
Well, I was thinking about doubloons all week because, speaking of doubloons, I bought some digital doubloons this week.
Which crashed pretty much after you bought them.
I bought some Bitcoin in what is probably the greatest bubble in the history of humankind. And I believe I bought in at the peak of the greatest bubble.
Idiots, because I remember you and I talking about Bitcoin back in 2011. And I was like, I'm going to admit I was wrong. I'm like, it's never going to take off. It's never going to be a big deal. And then it went to $5,000 a Bitcoin, or even more. And you could have bought it for $30 back in, 2010?
You could have bought it for a dollar, a cent. I had a bunch of them. I think I had about $1,000 worth when they were $200.
Right.
And I just sold them. And I thought, oh, just for fun, because I wanted to set up a new digital wallet and just for fun I bought in. And then it just proceeded to plummet 30%. And literally the next morning I wake up and it's like, oh, I'm down 30%. Great.
Was it you that had a laptop that you had to throw out and had all your Bitcoins on it as well? Was that you?
Yeah, but it was only $15 worth of Bitcoin, so I didn't care
back
about that.
Back then.
Yeah, but now it's worth $20 million.
What's the new one that's up and coming? Is it Ripple?
Yeah, Ripple is looking interesting. There's so many
but I mean, I don't want to give financial advice on the show, but I'm definitely going to start buying just a small amount, maybe a couple of $100 worth of some of these up and coming currencies, because if they take off, you could end up making a lot of money.
Well, I think officially, because I own Ripple, I would recommend everyone to buy Ripple. And recommend to their family members and friends to also buy Ripple and also pass on for them to buy Ripple as well.
The reason why Ripple is a big deal is because apparently they're negotiating with the Chinese government, aren't they, to make it their blockchain technology.
Yeah.
Something like that. There's these rumors. It's not confirmed.
They're testing it with banks all over the world, but I don't want to go into that. That's just as boring as the wine stuff.
Yeah, right, okay.
Right.
Well, give it some underground basis.
I was thinking about digital doubloons.
Okay.
So I thought, why not go into some real doubloon stories?
Oh, that's
so
a good idea.
I dug into the archives because the whole week I've been looking at underground, not base stuff, but you know those classical stories of a miner fell into a weird shaft and then the strange tunnel that he was in looked like it was man-made and the walls were all smooth and then he went down and there was a weird, humanoid.
Yeah, they're my favorite stories.
Are you a surface person?
Yeah.
You know, those kind of stories. Yeah. And
even the shaver kind of stuff.
Yeah, that kind of stuff. It's always really fun. And I went back to the library and picked out this old 2009 copy we have from David Hatcher Childress, this fantastic researcher that always looks at these lost city. He has actually a series on lost cities. And I picked up Lost Cities and Ancient Mysteries of the Southwest. And I was basically going through looking for these tales, adventures to the underworld and the inner earth and that kind of fun stuff. And I do have some of those stories coming up. But I did find a story about doubloons, which ultimately leads us to Black Ops connections.
Oh.
To money being funneled into reverse engineering alien projects.
Right.
So we end up in an odd place from a simple story about doubloons. Well, this starts because in the Lost Cities and Ancient Mysteries of the Southwest, Childress is on a road trip. He's traveling all through that area. And I'm going to pick up the story where he's heading west towards White Sands Missile Range. And this really desolate area, he says, on the east side of the Rio Grande that holds the great lost treasure of the Apache chief, Victorio. This is really what the story is about, the lost gold of Victoria Peak. And to set up this story, he gives a bit of background on ancient tunnels and underground works throughout the Americas. He reported in his previous book, Lost Cities and Ancient Mysteries of South America, the gold-clad mummies of the ancient Inca kings and much of the treasure from the fabulous Sun Temple. And it's all still believed to be hidden in the tunnels that run under Cuzco. And we recently covered this with the tales from Stan Hall.
Yes.
In the Americas, finding the Golden Library. And he says there's many of these stories, but one of them tells of a treasure hunter who went into the tunnels and wandered through the labyrinth for several days. And one morning, about a week after the adventurer had vanished, there was a priest, he says, conducting mass in the Church of Santo Domingo, which is actually built on the ruins of an Incan temple of the sun. And this book is full of all these stories that are just these crazy anecdotes. And the priest is talking to the congregation, and all of a sudden they're interrupted by this Indiana Jones moment of doof, 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 this knocking from underneath the floor. And several worshippers are like, oh, Diablo, it's a Diablo. But the priest quietens down the congregation, and he gets some people to help him remove this large stone slab from the floor. And as everyone's gathered around, out comes this treasure hunter that's been missing for a week with two massive bars of gold.
Oh.
It's like, hello. He just disappears out of the church. And, you know, this is where all these Indiana Jones stories come from, these old tales of adventurers going missing in these underground tunnels and just finding all this gold. And he states that the Peruvian government eventually got their fingers in this pie. There was an expedition that supposedly took place by staff from Lima University in 1923. And they had an experienced spelunker with them, and the party allegedly penetrated the trapezoid-shaped tunnels starting from an entrance at Cuzco. They took measurements of this subterranean aperture and advanced in the direction of the coast. And after a few days, according to the story, members of the expedition at the entrance of the tunnel lost contact with the explorers inside, and no communication came for 12 days. Then finally, a solitary, starving explorer returned to the entrance with reports of an underground labyrinth of tunnels and deadly obstacles that, again, were just like an Indiana Jones movie.
About to say, yeah, very Indiana Jones.
Well, the response from the Peruvian government and his colleagues were that this guy's insane and we need to dynamite the entrance so that no one else discovers these insane things in there.
Don't you always find that to be a bit peculiar, though, when, you know, they're claiming that something's impossible or something's insane, and yet they're going to go and dynamite the entrance? I mean, why not send an expedition in?
Well, as we'll eventually learn, it's usually the powers that be.
Right. Don't want outsiders going in.
They like to get their hands on the treasures.
Get it.
Now, there's also a belief held by some that these kind of underground tunnels, these underground works, are also in North America. They exist under Arizona, New Mexico, maybe Utah, Nevada, and California as well. And he uses the example of Geronimo, you know, how the American army was pursuing Geronimo and his braves all around Arizona. And there's all these stories of how Geronimo would lead his Braves into box canyons in Arizona with the cavalry right behind them, and then the Indians would vanish. The cavalry would be looking everywhere for them, and they would have no idea where they went. And then a day or two later, it would be reported that Geronimo and his troops had suddenly turned up in Mexico, hundreds of miles away.
But is that suggesting that there are tunnels that run for hundreds of miles?
Well, this happened not once, Childress says, but several times. So some people have speculated, as crazy as this sounds, that Geronimo was using a system of ancient tunnels that exist under the American Southwest. Other tunnels, he says, have been reported in the Superstition Mountains and elsewhere in Arizona. But one of the most curious of all is the tunnel and lost treasure reported at Victoria Peak in the Jornada del Muerto of New Mexico. And he picks up the trip in the story because, remember, he's doing his own personal trip and kind of writing a travel diary while he's describing all these places. So he says the next day they took Interstate 25 north of the town of Hatch, which is along the southern Rio Grande. And he says it was near the town of Hatch that in 1937, a half-Indian podiatrist named Milton Ernest Doc Noss discovered an astonishing cache of lost treasure. And this is who the story really starts with, Doc Noss. Actually, before that, we need to talk about Victoria Peak and how it got its name. So Victoria Peak, if you want to do a Google image search of it, if you're in front of your computer, it's this craggy outcropping of rock about 500 feet high. And it's just this minor peak of the San Andreas Range. There's nothing super special about it. But the peak was named after this Apache chief, Victorio. And he used this region as his stronghold. Now, if you go back to the history, in 1862, this Apache, Victorio, he joined up with another Apache leader, Mangus Coloradus, and they went on raiding parties together. But after Mangus died in 1863, it was Victorio who emerged as the tribal leader. And he was basically leading 300 warriors across this region on raids. In 1869, he and his band settled near Fort Craig, New Mexico, and they were basically awaiting the completion of a new reservation in New Mexico. And they had this treaty, well, he had this treaty between himself and the federal government, but the treaty was broken in 1878 because gold was found in the area where they were going to build this new reservation.
Oh, I see.
So the whole thing was cancelled.
Right.
Now, this sent Victorio and his Braves on a warpath. For several years, they were just raiding settlements around the area, robbing travelers and stagecoaches. And it was said that over this time, he had amassed a huge treasure. He had boxes of gold coins from Wells Fargo. It was said that he was really vicious too. He would take prisoners back to this hollow mountain where he would torture them before killing them. Now, ultimately, they disappeared from the area in August of 1880. They were pursued by soldiers out of Texas. Long story short, they made their way to Chihuahua in Mexico, and eventually the Mexican army kind of cornered them and killed Victorio and all his soldiers, and there was only about 200 of them by that stage. And so that was the end of Victorio, and not much was, you know, said about the peak that was named after him since then. But during a hunting party in 1937, again, this podiatrist from Oklahoma, Milton Doc Noss, he was this tall, handsome, energetic man. He was caught in a rainstorm under a rocky overhang near the summit of that mountain. And while he was waiting for the rain to subside, he noticed a stone on the floor that looked like it had been worked. It looked like it had been chiseled or smoothed over. Now, reaching down, he couldn't budge it, but after digging around the rock and, you know, removing some of the soil, he could slowly get his fingertips under this rock. And when he lifted it up, he found a hole that went straight down inside the mountain, inside Victoria Peak.
So like an entrance to something?
Yeah, some kind of weird entrance. No, he peers into the darkness and he can see this old man-made shaft with this thick wooden pole attached to one side. Now, he doesn't want to go in yet because he's not equipped, so he waits for the rain to stop. He doesn't tell anyone about what he's found. He returns to the camp and tells his wife over about what he's found. Now, she again convinces him, don't tell anyone. We'll go there tomorrow and investigate. So with what little money they have, they buy supplies. They get flashlights, batteries, a bunch of ropes, some exploration gear, a couple of hard hats. And they return to the peak and make sure nobody's following them. Now, when they arrive at the entrance again, they don't want to use, or Doc doesn't want to use this really ancient-looking pole ladder that's going down. So he kind of shimmies himself down with ropes and his wife, Ova, stays up top and just watches. And he's slowly moving down this rope into this narrow passageway. It's nearly 60 feet down. And he comes across a boulder, which looks like it's blocking the whole thing, but he manages to shimmy around it. And he finds himself at the bottom of this shaft. He walks forward into this passage and there's this small room that opens up, like this natural cavern in the rock. And there's chiseled rock art on the walls, there's paintings. And at the end of this room, there's another shaft going deeper into the mountain.
When you say paintings, is it something that someone recently has just drawn there, or is it something that looks like it's...
No details from Childress, so I imagine, I'm presuming from the Indians that were in there.
Right.
But Doc descends down into this passage, and he doesn't need a rope for this. It's kind of enough that he can just shimmy down. And he's about 125 feet down into the second shaft when it levels out into this larger natural cavern that has several rooms. Now, it stretches off into the darkness, but he can immediately see before him a skeleton of a man whose hands had been tied behind his back. He was in a kneeling position with his neck tied to a stake driven into the ground. And it was clear to Noss that this was a prisoner that had been tortured and left to die. So this was probably one of the prisoners that had been taken by Victorio when he was going on his raids. Mm. Now, as the glare from his flashlight goes further into the back of the cavern, Noss sees more skeletons, again, bound to stakes with their hands tied. And later on, he finds another cavern, like another room going off this cavern, with a stacked pile of bodies, 27 in total, he counts. Now, as he continues to explore, he starts to find some chests, and they say Wells Fargo on the side of them. He finds coins, jewels, saddles, priceless artifacts, gold crucifixes, a statue of Mary, and there's old letters as well, dated to 1880, which is the year Victorio fled the mountain to try and get to Mexico.
Oh.
So I don't know if he knew the history, but what an amazing find. And he also came to an underground stream. It was dark and wide as he ventured deeper into the caverns. And he managed, with the aid of a staff, because it was quite deep, he managed to leap across this stream, according to the story. And he entered this main treasure area of the cavern, which comprised of an altar room, a living room, and a bedroom, and finally another room stacked with bars. Now, these bars weighed about 40 pounds each, he says, but Noss just assumed they were made of lead or iron because they were just dark and dirty. They didn't look like gold, that's for sure. So he fills his pockets with gold coins. He grabs a few jeweled swords, grabs a letter or two from the 1800s, and makes his way back up to his wife at the surface. And when he comes up, he tells her about all these amazing things that he's found. And all she wants him to do is go back and get those iron bars. Because she has a feeling that...
Yeah, why would you do that? It doesn't make sense that you'd have iron bars in Wells Fargo boxes?
No, they weren't in the boxes. The Wells Fargo boxes had the coins in them.
Right.
But these bars were stacked up.
Even so, though,
there was a ton of them.
You wouldn't just stack up iron bars for the hell of it.
Well, he said there was thousands of them. So why would you hide away thousands of iron bars? What are you going to do with them? So she's like, go back, go get one of these bars. So he's like, all right, he goes back down. He gets one of these bars and he gets the smallest one he can find. It weighs about 40 pounds. And as he's hauling it back up to his wife, she looks at the bar and she notices where it's been scratched on the gravel, it's shining underneath. So she clears away the grit and, of course, it's not worthless iron. It's a solid gold bar. Now, it's now been estimated from the various versions of this story, because there's a lot of versions of this story, there was 100 tons of gold in this cave.
100 tons?
Yeah. That's a lot of
Bitcoin. That's a lot of Bitcoin, yeah. Wow.
And I was doing the calculations today. I think it came, I was running out of calculator spots, but it came to 41 billion or something in today's currency.
Wow.
If you converted that gold today to US dollars, yep. 41 billion. So eureka, they found this lost treasure. Absolutely incredible. And you know, this is beyond their wildest dreams. They take some of the gold coins to a pawn shop and they camp at the base of this peak and start exploring the tunnels inside the mountain. Ovo would apparently always stay on top and Doc would go inside and he would just be pulling out gold bars. This was a huge operation because, again, there was thousands of these things in there. And on each trip, he would bring back two gold bars because that's all he could really carry, and a bunch of smaller artifacts like coins and maybe some documents and old letters. Now, it's said that he brought up to 88 bars just from doing these trips. And all this other treasure, including gold and silver crowns. Apparently, he found 243 diamonds, a really large ruby. There was a lot of stuff down there. But the story gets intriguing because gold fever had started to strike. And Doc Noss was starting to mistrust everyone. He was becoming paranoid.
Well, as you would with $41 billion worth of gold sitting around.
And he started to distrust his wife as well.
Now,
he would kind of organize to her to be somewhere else, and then he would go into the desert and bury the gold for himself. Now, the problem was this was 1937, and in 1933, the Gold Reserve Act had been passed. So it was basically illegal to have private ownership of gold.
Oh, right.
You had to sell all your gold to the Federal Reserve. So there was a huge problem for him because it was illegal for him to have all this gold.
So, but hang on, was that gold rush times though? So people were mining it at the same time, but then they have to give it back?
I had the wiki page open for the Gold Act of 1933, but I closed it earlier. I think the details were that they had raised the price of gold and made it illegal for private citizens to hold gold. So you basically had to give it to the feds. And what they were trying to do was stimulate inflation.
Oh, okay.
From memory.
Right. But they would pay you for the gold, obviously.
So they were raising the gold price in America so that it would encourage gold to come into the United States from other countries.
Right.
So they're basically, the Americans were hoarding gold.
They're doing what China is doing now.
Yeah, what China and Russia are doing now. Yeah. Exactly. Now, because of this issue, it was kind of screwed. You find the biggest gold ever, and you can't do anything with it. So he just started to hide it in the desert. He was just burying it all over the place. And eventually they tried to go legal. So he and Ova, they filed a lease in 1938, and they had several mining claims for Victoria Peak and made a claim of a treasure trove. So eventually they got this. They were the rightful owners of the claim, and they could openly work the area. But the paranoia kept on growing, and Doc Noss just kept on hiding more gold. Then in late 1939, he wanted to enlarge the passageway so he could get more gold out, because he can only bring out two gold bars each trip. So he hires this mining engineer named S.E. Montgomery. Doc takes him to the mountain, explains that he wants this passageway widened. And this mining engineer says, I recommend 80 sticks of dynamite.
Oh, God.
And Doc Noss is saying, I don't know, that might be a little bit too much. Maybe 2 sticks of dynamite? And the engineer says, trust me, 80 sticks minimum.
So they just tell this is a bad idea.
So they just load up this shaft, this fragile mountain with 80 sticks of dynamite, blow it up. And the whole shaft collapses.
Of course
just
it does.
Half the
of
mountain is, gets
does.
Destroyed. And there's this story in the book of Doc Noss basically trying to murder this engineer. And the engineer's like, trying to run back to his truck and drive away while Noss is trying to murder him. So this caused a huge cave-in and it collapsed this fragile shaft. And effectively, Noss was shut out of his own mind. I mean,
but how much does he need? I mean, he's got all of that gold he's pulled out so far. It goes to show you greed becomes...
That's the whole point, is he had pulled millions of dollars of gold bars out already.
Yeah, think yourself lucky.
But he was obsessed with gaining entrance to the mine again. So he ultimately became a bitter, frustrated, angry man. and it caused problems in his marriage. He started to become even more secretive with Ova. He started to have affairs with other women. He left Ova and they got divorced in November of 1945.
Did she take half of his gold?
Well, he married this Violet Lena Bowles 2 years later. But this complicated everything because now she would have rights to the treasure and the ex-wife whose name was on the treasure claims would also have rights to the treasure. And there were all these counter-ownership claims being filed over who had control of it. So, and remember, the whole time he can't sell any of this gold because of the Gold Reserve Act of 1933. So he starts to think of ways to sell it on the black market. Long story short, he eventually teams up with this guy named Joseph Andreg, and they transport some of the treasure to Arizona, and there's like a border town black market to kind of sell the gold in Mexico because it's not illegal to sell it in Mexico. But the problem is he's got all this gold. How's he going to find a buyer for so much of the stuff? You know, this is the problem that drug dealers have. You've got millions of dollars of cash and you've got to launder it somehow. He's trying to launder all this gold. Now, the end kind of came for him when he met an oil explorer named Charlie Ryan in 1948. And Ryan had the cash to buy the gold. He had finally found his buyer. And they made an agreement that Noss would turn over some of the gold bars for $25,000 in cash from Ryan. Now, Noss was also intrigued with this relationship because Ryan had the technology from his oil exploration business to possibly open up the shaft again and get even more gold out. So they had this loose kind of agreement. He would give him bars and he would get 25K cash, which was a lot of money back in 1948.
Yeah, absolutely.
So the way they kind of solidified this agreement is they both went to a spot in the desert and buried the gold together. That was their holding spot. It had this mutual trust going on.
This sounds just like Breaking Bad.
It is exactly like Breaking Bad. But Doc Noss, because he was ultra paranoid, after the meeting where they buried the gold, he was like, nah, screw it. He goes out there the next day, he digs it up and he moves it to somewhere else. Doesn't trust this guy. Now, ultimately, the handover was going to take place where Ryan, this oil guy, was going to get a private plane, fly it in, get the gold bars and give Noss the 25K in cash. And then he was going to take the gold to Mexico. Now, Ryan found out that Noss had moved the gold and he was furious. And all of this, there's a whole book written about this, which is, I had the paperback curse today. There was no Kindle version of it. But all of this culminates, again, in a Breaking Bad scenario, where on March the 5th, 1949, Doc Noss arrives at Ryan's place in the town of Hatch, and Charlie Ryan's sitting at the kitchen table with his pistol in his hand, waiting for him. And he demands that Noss tell him where he's moved the gold. And Noss insists, you give me the 25K cash and I'll show you where the gold is.
So this stalemate.
This argument starts heating up. They start yelling at each other. They argued and argued, and Ryan threatened Noss, saying he wouldn't live to enjoy his gold if he didn't tell him where it was buried. And in this intense argument, Ryan's flaunting his pistol. Noss suddenly runs to his car. Now, Ryan later testified that he believed that Noss was going for his own gun in his car. And Ryan, as Noss is running to his car, Ryan demands that he gets away from the vehicle. Noss refuses, reaches into the car. Ryan shoots him in the back of the head, killing him instantly.
Oh, wow.
This is the end of Noss. He's murdered. Now, Charlie Ryan, he stood trial for this shooting. He was eventually acquitted. The jury believed that he was under
self-defense
because Noss was going for a gun in the car. He never paid out 25K. He never got any gold. And Doc Noss died with $2.16 in his pocket. And the gold he buried in the desert was never found.
Which means it's still out there, right?
Which means it's still out there. And I got to the end of this story and I thought, oh, that's kind of an intriguing story. That's nowhere near the end of this madness. Wait until the military gets involved in this crazy story of Black Ops Gold. That's coming up after this on Mysterious Universe. Stay with us. Okay. Support for today's podcast comes from Squarespace. Ready to start your new business? Make it stand out with Squarespace. With beautiful templates created by world-class designers, Squarespace makes it easy to turn your idea into a new and unique website. Have you been checking out the new templates and sections on the Squarespace site?
Yeah, I have. I'm really surprised. Well, I shouldn't be surprised, but I know that Squarespace is fantastic, but they just keep on getting better and better. It's just so simple, but looks really great.
I had a good example of how effective they are the other day. I was looking for the menu of a restaurant online, and I looked up their website for the restaurant, and it was just a 20 megabyte PDF that just started downloading on my phone.
Oh, God.
So it's just annoying. I got to wait for it to download and try and expand it with my fingers and find the menu. And then a couple of days later, we were going out again. So I looked up this different restaurant online and it was a Squarespace website. So immediately it's beautifully formatted for my phone. Everything looks amazing. And it was just, night and day.
Which is what people want. If you're trying to get an idea out there or run a business online, you want to make it simple. Simplicity is what drives people to keep coming to your website and utilizing it, because you don't want to tick off your customers. That's the last thing you want to do. And obviously with Squarespace, you can customize the look and feel of everything to make it exactly the way that you want it. And of course, Squarespace has this great analytics system, which allows you to grow in real time. And everything is optimized for mobile right out of the box. They've got 200 extensions to choose from, and they offer new ways to buy domains. So anything you can think of, Squarespace is there to support you with it. They've got 24/7 customer support. It's just a dream to set up a website with Squarespace.
Head to squarespace.com today for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, use the offer code MU to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. That's squarespace.com, offer code MU. We're back on Mysterious Universe with Lost Cities and Ancient Mysteries of the Southwest from David Hatcher Childress, retelling this tale of Victorio Peak's gold. And we've just heard how Doc Noss has been shot dead by this oil man in the desert. And meanwhile, his ex-wife, Ova Noss, she now deems herself owner of the mountain. And she's hired various men to try and clear out the rubble from the central shaft. She believes she can get back in there and get the gold out. And this is where the military steps into the story. Because in 1955, the military starts expanding their operations and it starts encompassing the Hembrio Basin, where this peak is, where this shaft is, where the gold is. And Ova starts negotiating with the military. But long story short, that doesn't go well. And ultimately, where the mine shaft is now becomes White Sands Missile Range.
Oh, wow.
So
I didn't see that coming.
Every time she tries to go out there and get into that mine shaft again, she's escorted by military out of the area.
But if she's got ownership of that treasure, shouldn't she be able to get access to it?
Well, no, there was a ruling at the time from the state that basically rescinded all rights when the military was expanding their area for testing. I mean, it was...
I see, right, yeah. So all mineral rights, everything else like that, all get cast aside.
It's the start of the Cold War. You know, the military comes
can do
first.
What it wants. Yep.
And Victoria Peak and its fantastic secret basically fall victims to America's military buildup. And I'm like, that's a really weird end to the story, that this strange gold find ended up on White Sands military base.
But
that's not the end of the story.
Yeah. I was about to say, it's a little bit sus, right?
4 years later, Ova's shut out of the mountain. However, the army can still go to the region, right? They're on the army grounds. Two airmen from nearby Holloman Air Force Base, they later said that they had found the gold cavern in 1958. They claimed that they were able to enter the cave from another natural opening on a different side of the peak. The soldiers were Airman First Class Thomas Burlett and Captain Leonard Fage. They claimed that they had found approximately 100 gold bars weighing between 40 and 80 pounds each in a small cavern in Victoria Peak. So again, millions of dollars worth of gold bars. Burlett and Fage, they formed a corporation and they actually made a formal application to the White Sands base for search and retrieval of the gold. They were going through the proper routes, the official routes to do this.
And did you say 40 to 80 pounds?
Yeah.
That's huge.
Yeah, they're massive gold. They're massive gold bars. That's why he could only carry out two at a time.
That's like 40 kilos. That's a huge amount of weight.
Yeah.
Amazing.
I mean, if... Imagine you have to carry millions of dollars out as quickly as possible. I reckon I could carry 80 kilos.
For millions of dollars, I can carry 80 kilos.
All that money adrenaline.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, they form this corporation and White Sands basically bans the whole thing. The White Sands base expressly forbids them to return to the area. And finally, during the summer of 1961, the Major General, John Schinkel of White Sands, he's issued advice from the director of the, you know, the Federal Mint or whatever, saying that they should be allowed to retrieve this gold. And Captain Fage and Captain Orby Swanner, Major Kelly and Colonel Gorman are suddenly given permission to work the claim. Now, I won't spend too much time on this story, but it's basically they return on August the 5th of 1961. And with this military escort, they've got 14 military police, there's Secret Service agents involved for some reason. They attempt to tunnel back into this opening, but every attempt they make fails. And General Schinkel from White Sands, he's had enough and he orders everyone out. But it's said that after this, because the military general thought that the whole thing was bogus, that there was never any gold in the first place, and it was all just a ruse. But according to the story, they put Fage, one of these airmen, under a lie detector test, asking him about the gold. And he passed with flying colors.
Oh, interesting.
Now, the army became very interested. All of a sudden, they thought, the gold's probably real. And this is where it gets... This gets kind of strange. There's a conspiracy about a so-called Operation Goldfinger, named after the movie.
About to say, as in James Bond.
And a lot of this stuff is from the book I'll link to in the show notes. It's from the author Chandler, and it's called 100 Tons of Gold. Again, I couldn't get it in time because it's only in paperback. But he claims that this mysterious man named Fred Drolte was a CIA operative who facilitated the removal of the gold. And according to this story, over the course of a number of flights, the army went in, they figured out how to open the shaft, they started pulling the gold out. And this guy, he was a gun runner for the CIA. And he through a number of flights, flew out 100 tons of gold from this area, from Victoria Peak. And again, meanwhile, during this time, there's another judge named Moreland from New Mexico who's working with Over Noss to try and legally get control of the mine again. And basically they have a court order that orders the military to shut down operations. Under the cover of darkness, they sneak back onto White Sands, go to the peak, but they can't find anything there. There's no trace of any gold, and the military's installed these huge iron doors that have locked off the shaft.
Oh, right.
Now, this suggests that the army got everything.
Yeah.
But the army denied getting anything at all. So the question is, who actually got the gold in the end? Is it true that the CIA and the military were flying gold bars out? Were they able to get in there and get the rest of the gold? There's evidence that connects Nixon to the gold. Apparently he knew it was there. And then came this lawsuit because eventually word started to spread about this story. This famous lawyer, F. Lee Bailey, he got involved in the dispute and he litigated in 1972 for over 50 clients. He was representing Over Noss, the ex-wife of Doc Noss. He was representing Captain Fage, the airman who had found it after Noss. He was representing Doc's second wife. He was representing some other company that wanted to excavate the area. And ultimately, they reached a compromise with the military. They settled out of court. And the military said, okay, 1977, you can go in, you can excavate, but you can only do it for 2 weeks. So they go down there. The time is of the essence. And 2 weeks is not enough to excavate a collapsed mine shaft. It's not even close to being enough time. So, of course, the army knows this and they run out of time and they find no fortune at all. That's the end of their attempt, this lawsuit. But the mystery of Victoria Peak doesn't end there, because the wife, the ex-wife Ove Noss, she dies in 1979. And it's said that to this day, her grandson, Terry Delonis, he's still trying to gain access to this peak. He's still trying to get inside there to see if there's any gold left. But around this time, a prospector named Harvey Snow, who lives in the area, was approached by three ranchers. And Snow had spent 25 years exploring the entire White Sands region. I mean, he was your guy. He knew the entire place back to front. And the ranchers were approaching him because they felt that Snow could lead them to the treasure area. And they also felt he could bypass the army patrols. He would be able to sneak back onto White Sands without getting caught. Now, the problem was that Snow knew about the treasure, but Snow didn't believe the treasure was in Victoria Peak. He believed it was somewhere else. See, in all these treasure cave stories, there's always a dummy cave.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. There's always some subterfuge and, yeah, distractions.
Every time there's a dummy cave. So he believed the treasure was actually buried in Hard Scrabble Peak, a mountain that was close by. The reason he thought this is because a cowboy he had known for many, many years had come to him and told him of how he had actually seen Doc Noss one day disappear into a secret cave on Hard Scrabble Peak. And this cowboy, he watched this cave entrance. He watched for hours. And eventually, Doc Noss reemerges and he starts loading up his pack mules with something that looks clearly heavy.
The gold.
Exactly. So the cowboy, after he had seen Noss leave with something heavy, he decides to go into this hidden, nearly invisible cave, and he finds cut stairs going underground, and he starts following them. And they keep going, these stairs, down and down and down and down they go. But he didn't follow them to the bottom because ultimately he was afraid that Noss might come back and kill him. You know, if you had found someone, he thought, if this guy finds me with his gold hoard, I'm a goner.
Yeah,
the guy's going to shoot me. So he gets back out of there. He never went back to this cave. But he's told Snow about it. So Harvey Snow, he takes the ranchers to Hard Scrabble Peak in November of 1968. And they start searching this entire area. They've got all these supplies. They've got all this food. A couple of days, they run out of supplies. They try again. They come back and the ranchers actually leave Snow there to search the southern face of the mountain, and they're going to meet up again in a couple of days. Well, in this book, 100 Tons of Gold, the author actually speaks to Harvey Snow, and this is what Snow told him. He said, on the second day of searching, I found the cave. He found the cave with the sloping steps, and he said, I started to go down them, down and down and down. I don't know how far, he said. I estimated maybe 1,300 or 1,400 steps. He said the bottom step, the very last one, was rounded so that when you stepped on it, it would roll. And he claims that it had this ancient booby trap connected to it. It had a bow and arrow with raw hide, but the raw hide had rotted away. So that's what saved him.
Oh, so it wouldn't go off.
He stepped on it and it clicked,
yeah.
Like in the movies.
Yeah.
But then nothing was fired. Now, at the bottom, he said, you would come to this big room and there's a stream of water running through it, just like Noss had described. But he said it had a copper and sulfur taste to it. Now, he said, I followed it, going from room to room, and in many places I had to get down on my hands and knees and a few places on my belly. After the first room, where the steps come down, I came into another room. He said he found small stacks, one of gold, one of copper, and one of silver. And he figured that he would just come back for them, so he went on. He describes coming into another big room. There was a bunch of side tunnels, and everything was natural. Nothing's man-made. This is all just natural caverns. But ultimately, he came to this point where there was like an intersection. There was three paths to take, like it was a W in the cave.
So you kind of have to make a choice of where you go?
It's like, I have no memory of this place. And he decides to go straight ahead into the middle cave. And here's where it gets weird, because he continues on and he says, at the far end of this main room, I found some things I cannot tell you about. What?
Yeah, great.
What kind of a story is that? I found some things I can't tell you about, but he says, I'll tell you what happened next. I kept going, crawling, walking, crawling, hauling my little pack of food. This guy claims he crawled through this tunnel system for 2 days and two nights and eventually followed this tunnel for 14 miles. And as he's getting further and further into the tunnel, he could tell he's getting deeper and deeper into the White Sands missile test range. He can hear jets flying over. He can hear a train system going next to him. He can hear bombs falling. And he's thinking, this is crazy. I must be close to the surface. And finally, he feels this fresh air hitting his face. And he kind of pops up out of this hole. And boom, he's right in the middle of the missile testing range. Oh shit.
Wow, yeah.
Oh, no. So he eventually he pulls himself out of this tunnel. He sneaks his way off the base, and he wouldn't say what was in that main room. And this really gets on Childress. I mean, it's already incredible to think that he followed this tunnel for 14 miles underground, underneath the base. But what was in this main room that he couldn't describe? Was he sworn to secrecy over something? Were there bodies in there?
I was thinking that. Was it bodies?
Was there something so indescribable he thought that no one would ever believe him? I mean, the story's already crazy.
It's like a glowing jade monkey sitting yeah. in the middle of the room.
Yeah. Was there a naked alien waiting for him? Who knows what was going on in that room? Ultimately, this story ends with this question of, well, what happened to this hollow mountain of gold? Chief Victoria hoarded it and added to all this cursed treasure. Doc Noss got some of it, but ultimately blew up the entrance and got shot in the back of the head. Over Noss knew it was there, but she could never get to it. And ultimately, in the end, it seems as though the US Army got the treasure. Because there's a few other researchers who have looked into CIA activities in Asia who believe that a lot of what was funding it was the gold from Victoria Peak.
You know, it makes sense when you think about it, because I mean, we've spoken in the past about black projects and funding and how there's billions of dollars, which has just disappeared from the US budget, which no one knows what happened to it, and from the Treasury and whatever else. But then if you can find something like that, which never even hit the budget in the first place, it's invisible money.
He references John Dean, who wrote this book, Blind Ambition, in 1976. And in this book, he was researching CIA activities, and he referenced CIA operatives handling bars of gold. They would use this to fund their activities. And he was in touch with an agent named Edgell Crow, who would describe to the author how when he wasn't doing his desk work, he had carried bars of gold bullion through Asia's Golden Triangle in CIA planes and bargained with drug lords. The gold bars used in these illegal clandestine operations allegedly came from the tunnel system inside of Victoria Peak. So there's direct references to the CIA getting this gold. And months later, like months after Childress had published this book, he received an email from a Dr. Oren Sweringen, who told him a strange story that kind of dovetailed with this, with the story of the gold bars and the CIA. He said in this letter to Childress, I was really interested in your comments about Victoria Peak, and this just happens to be a subject I know a great deal about. The doctor said, there's a big error, and this is a lie told by Harvey Snow about his cave of steps. You know, the guy who said he went under this tunnel and saw something he can't describe or can't tell anyone about.
Miles.
He said, Harvey never went into the cave of steps, and he never even knew where it was. And secondly, it's not on Handscrabble Mountain. That's a dummy cave.
Oh, God.
There's always a second dummy cave.
Is there always?
When you're looking for doubloons.
Is there always two?
There's always two. The real cave was in Domion Canyon. Now, he claims that Harvey Snow got the story of the cave from a friend who never told him where it was, but he told me, I have been to the real cave. Harvey Snow finally admitted to me that he did not know where the cave was, and he told me who did know. I contacted this man, and he drove from Oklahoma to show me the cave. As for the number of steps in the cave, the doctor said, nobody knows how many there are because nobody's ever made it to the bottom. There's a cave out there in Domayon Canyon with endless steps that no one's ever had the guts to get to the bottom of.
Well, they're probably booby-trapped from what we've heard.
That's right. Everyone that's tried has died on step number 487.
So what happened?
That's it.
That's it. No one went down there.
No one's ever reached there.
That's it.
Well, people have gone in there, but you just, after 3 days of walking downstairs, you get bored and you go back up again.
Yeah,
people have tried.
Yeah.
2 weeks down there. Go back up again.
Eventually, surely it can't be that deep.
Eventually your supplies run out. You've got to go up. There's just more steps. Think about it.
Surely it can't be that deep.
Think about it. If there's millions of steps.
I don't believe millions of steps. See, it's gone from hundreds of thousands to millions. Next to be hundreds of millions.
There's a billion steps. How would you take the supplies down there?
A sled?
That's a lot of Fruit Loops to go down that. There, you get a sled.
A sled.
You get a sled down there.
Yes.
That's your solution.
I would get a sled. I would get some, just, I don't know, like a big piece of board, and I'd sit on it and I'd go flying down.
All right. So you'd get on your sled that's going to go down this ancient staircase and then you're going to be fine. What are you going to wear? Like a luge helmet?
Yeah.
Like it's the Olympics?
Yeah.
All right. You're going to luge down a billion steps.
Yes.
And say you're going 100 kilometers an hour luging down these ancient steps. Let's just say it takes you a week to hit the end. Then what?
I guess it's a long walk back up.
You'll die down there.
Well, no, by luge, you'll have a whole heap of supplies on it, so I'll have enough to get back.
No, but it takes a week to get down there at 100 k's an hour on a luge. It's going to take you months to climb back out.
Think about it, right? Think about what you're saying, right? You're traveling at 100 miles an hour for a week. There's no possibility that it's that deep.
All right. Yeah, that is crazy. The idea that there's a bunch of steps that no one ever made it to the end.
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
I find that really hard to believe. But this guy did say that when you say that the gold in the peak was taken out by the army, this is absolutely true. Some of it ended up on the LBJ ranch, you know, Lyndon Johnson. And this was indicating that the JFK assassination was connected with LBJ trying to acquire the gold, because once he became president, he could then control the gold.
So what, they killed off JFK so that they could sell the gold?
The gold. Wasn't for UFOs. It wasn't because Marilyn Monroe knew about UFOs. It wasn't because of some other conspiracy. It was all about the gold from Victoria Peak and the endless steps.
See, I don't buy the endless steps, but I kind of can see that it's a possibility for a conspiracy theory.
So who got the doubloons in the end?
Yeah, well, the army, right? Sure, the CIA.
The CIA got it, and it ultimately went to drug lords in Thailand.
But that doesn't make sense either, because then why were they buying drugs? What, to flood the American market?
Well, the CIA was doing all sorts of stuff with a lot of money.
Oh, that's a good way to launder it, of course.
To geopolitically control other nations.
Right, of course.
I mean, you could buy it with that much gold. Think about it. 1,000 tons of gold.
You can buy anything you want.
I'd just buy India.
Yeah.
Just buy it.
Yeah, not a problem.
You'd have change left over. Now, just quickly, I want to tell you another story that I'll kind of summarize right down, because I'm trying to make the point that with a lot of these lost gold tales, it usually ends up with the military getting their hands on the shiny stuff. So there's a case of two men, we only know their surnames from this story, White and Thomason. And apparently they claim that they found an underground city in Death Valley. White and Thompson claimed that they found the catacombs after one of them had fallen through the bottom of an old mine shaft near Wingate Pass, and this is southwest, the southwest corner of Death Valley. And the men said they found themselves in this natural underground cavern. They claimed this went for 20 miles north to the heart of Panamint Mountains. And they claim they found themselves in this huge ancient underground cavern city, where there was perfectly preserved mummies clad in this fine leather. They had thick gold armbands and wielding gold spears. The city had been abandoned for ages, they claimed, except for the mummies. But this entire underground system looked really ancient. They described coming across this large, polished round table that looked like it was you know, part of some kind of ancient council chambers.
Was it metal or stone?
It was stone, like polished stone, but there were giant statues, they said, made of solid gold, stone vaults and drawers full of gold bars and gemstones. The most interesting thing about their story is they said that there was something ingenious about the engineering of the place. There were these huge giant stone doors that they couldn't move. Whatever they did, they just could not move them until one of them found a switch of sorts, which immediately made the doors just go pshht and open. And they said they couldn't actually see the hinges. Like the,
it's like Coral Castle kind of stuff, right?
Yeah, or the, what am I, what's the word I'm looking for?
The seals.
The tolerances were so tight.
Right.
The engineering tolerances were so tight, you couldn't actually see, yeah, the connection between the hinges and the door. They also said there was this really ingenious lighting method where somehow subterranean gases were funneled through this place. And one of the men accidentally got his flame too close to one of these gas lines, but it automatically lit the entire place because it lit this gas line and it created this lighting effect of the whole complex.
Light.
Yeah, this whole complex was lit up. And they claim that ultimately they came up to the side of the eastern slope of the mountain, and they realized that this whole area was a series of lakes because they found boats that were ancient boats that were ready to be put onto this lake, which no longer exists because today it's Death Valley. Now, if you go back into the history and you think, well, when was a lake last there? You got to go back over 10,000 years, 20,000 years, there would be a lake there. So this is really, really old stuff. This isn't, if you believe this crazy story.
Is this isn't Atlantean even 1,000 years kind old. Of stuff? Is that where it ends up going?
Well, all you can say is that if any of this is true, it's going back over 10,000 years.
Mm.
Now, after they left this area, they immediately went to the Smithsonian. They went to speak to scientists and to experts and to the government to try and get them to come and see this place because they knew that this was a miraculous find and they wanted to share it. But they were scoffed at and rejected by the experts because they went to, when they went to try and find the mine entrance again, they couldn't find it. Couldn't find it anywhere. They claimed that everything had changed. The area looked different. The weather was different. So all the terrain looked different. But they also told a story about the artifacts they had pulled out of this cavern, out of this city, because they had gems and gold bars. They claimed that a government man made friends with them. Very clean-cut guy in a suit. And he was very convincing. He convinced them that he was going to work with them, that the government was going to support them, and that they would get their share of the findings. But he needed to evaluate their artifacts. And he took them, and they never saw him again.
Mm-hmm.
Never saw him again. And this southwest portion of Death Valley, around Wingate Pass, where they claim they found all this, that is now China Lake Naval Weapons Center.
Oh. See, this is interesting because this is like those stories that you get from the UK, like Bentwaters, for example. You have all of these strange military, well, I shouldn't say strange, but you have military bases put seemingly coincidentally near places that are of strange activity. You know, and this would line up with that. I mean, it's strange that you've got this ancient civilization meeting room and now it's a military base.
Yeah, you see, if we want to go full Mysterious Universe on this episode, which we will.
Why not?
I mean, you could argue that they just wanted to get the gold, or it's just a coincidence. They just wanted to build a big military base and there just happened to be some crazy ancient underground city with a bunch of gold there. It's like it's a bit of a win-win.
Yeah, I think it's more than a coincidence. I really do. These things, the coincidence doesn't exist. You know, like, honestly, this is very, when it comes to things like this, I think it's very odd.
Or maybe some of these ancient places have lost technology that the military's trying to get.
That's a possibility as well.
So this is where we have the story of the journey to Palatquapi.
Palatquapi.
Yes. I don't know how to pronounce it. Palatquapi. So this is the story of Dr. Hank Crastman, who has spent the last 23 years researching and reporting on the Earth's ley lines, vortexes, men in black, crystals, crystal skulls, and Hopi entrances to the inner Earth, where the ant people live.
So obviously a very reliable source.
Well, in 1961, he claims, because he was interviewed in the early 90s on some crappy radio show. And in 1961, he says that he was attending class at the University of Northern Arizona, and he met this young guy with blue eyes, blonde hair, and his name was Carl Kapavi Waltz. Carl Kapavi Waltz. And through conversation, he learned that he was a Hopi Indian with Dutch ancestry, and he was planning on becoming a teacher. Now, he says the name Carl Waltz came from his great-grandfather, Jacob Waltz, who was from Holland. And because Dr. Hank Krassman is telling this story, is also Dutch, that was their connection, and they became friends. Okay. They were like, I'm from Holland. Oh, you're from Holland. Isn't that weird? Let's be friends. That's basically...
Isn't that weird?
That's how their relationship formed.
Right.
And Jacob Waltz... this is where I realized this afternoon that it'll be hard to tell this without telling you the whole story of the Lost Dutchman's Gold Mine. So what I'll do is if you haven't heard of the story of the Lost Dutchman's Gold Mine, I'll put a couple of links in the show notes so you can read up on it. There's a whole bunch of versions of this story. It's become a real urban legend as well. It basically, one version of the story involves two German men, Jacob Waltz and Jacob Weiser, and they somehow found this rich gold mine in the Superstition Mountains. And it was apparently just an endless vein of gold. In one version of the story, Weiser is attacked and wounded. It's either by Apaches or a greedy Waltz. But he survives long enough to tell this other guy, Dr. Walker, and eventually the story spreads. But ever since then, no one's been able to find this cave. And the book from Childress has all these tales of people in the Superstition Mountains from the 1950s onwards who were looking for this cave. They were looking for this hidden mine from the Dutchman who, and he wasn't Dutch anyway, he was German, but they just called them the Dutchman, who had found this almost endless vein of gold. So going back to our story from Dr. Hank Krassman, he claims that this young kid that he met was related to the original Dutchman who found that golden mine. He says his great-grandfather was Jacob Waltz. And the true story is that Jacob Waltz had lived with the Pima Indians in the Superstition Mountains and managed to gain their trust. Now, once he gained their trust, they used him to take sacks of salt to the people that live in the underground.
Sacks of salt.
Yeah, you see, in the underworld, they don't have much salt, but they got a shit ton of gold. So what he would do is take in sacks of salt and walk out with sacks of gold.
Makes sense. Why not?
So there never really was any Lost Dutchman's mine. There never was a vein of gold there.
They're just trading with underground subterranean entities.
Yes, he's trading with people from the inner earth. That's the true story, Aaron. That's what's going on.
I would probably go with a vein of gold as opposed to it being a true story that they're basically dealing with a subterranean species.
Well, look, because Dr. Hank Krassman and his buddy who is related to the old Dutchman, because they're both Dutch and they're bros, one day he says to Hank, would you like to actually see the mine? Would you like me to take you there? And of course, he's like, yeah, I'd love to see the entrance to the underground. I'm thrilled. Let's go. So first they go to the Grand Canyon and they hire two donkeys, according to the story. And then Kapavi brings out a blindfold and explains eventually that the Council of Nine has given him permission to enter, but he must cover his eyes for the rest of the ride. So the doctors... explaining how for like 8 hours, he's just on the back of this donkey with a blindfold, trying to hang on for dear life. And after what seems like an eternity, eventually Kapavi removes the blindfold. And as he adjusts his eyes to the light, he can see that they're in this large clearing against this canyon wall. And after stretching a bit, he turns to Kapavi, who's standing next to the cliff wall. And he points to the solid wall and says, put your hand on the wall, doctor. So the doctor reaches out and his hand goes through the wall.
Oh, wow.
Like, whoa. He says, it seemed that the cliff was only a created illusion to keep unwanted people away. Actually, it was the entrance to a large secret cave called P- Poopovi. As we walked inside, I was amazed, he said, to find the cave was brightly lit. And before us was a sort of escalator-type device which you laid down on. There was some sort of transparent bubble which covered you called a Howiovi. My heart was beating so fast, he said, so I stood looking at this strange sight as I caught my breath. Now I have a confession to make, he says. For years, I've been telling people that this is as far as I went. But I lied. That's right, Hank Crassman lied. He didn't stop there. He kept on going. He's now been given permission to tell the full story. He said, actually, I did proceed from this point all the way into the underground Hopi city of Palatquapi. I am putting the whole story in my new book entitled Kapavi, which I'm currently working on.
And has that yet been published?
No.
Right.
He died.
Oh, right.
He died. Only part of the way down, he said, at the bottom of the escalator, we boarded a Putuvota, a flying machine which moved through subterranean tunnels on energy fields. I will go into detail on this in my upcoming book.
Oh, then he dropped dead.
He says, he eventually gives more information. They basically went to this underground city. When he's asked by the radio host, well, can you tell us about the buildings? He said, oh, yeah, they're kind of Greek. They look Greek, the Greek buildings. And he talks about this purification room where all their germs are removed before they can enter the city. Essentially, he's describing the inner earth. He's going to the inner earth. But this initial description of descending down via this strange escalator device, this explains the million steps that no one's ever got to the bottom of.
I knew you were to go there. I knew you were to go there.
In the other cave, they just weren't working. That's why it took so long. See, if the escalator steps were working.
Right. You'd speed right up.
It would speed right up. Yep. Because in this story, the good doctor, Dr. Crassman, he claims that the steps travel at the speed of light. Now, I don't know the kind of...
Yeah, okay. Because you do realize accelerating to the speed of light without inertial dampeners would turn you into Swiss cheese.
I'm not an escalator physicist by any means, but no. I imagine when the escalator hits the speed of sound, let alone the speed of light. Well, he did say you were strapped into a bubble type device. So let's
That does have... But obviously, inertial dampeners don't exist. That's just a sci-fi concept.
How can you say that?
Well, obviously these ancient people had them. How could you be so disrespectful of the technology?
You see, this is the connection to the military. The military is only mildly interested in the gold. The military wants to expand their bases to cover these places so that they can get the light speed escalator technology. They want to get the bubble device. They want to get the cavern camouflage technology. This is the whole point.
Makes sense.
And there was a little epilogue to the end of this radio interview with the good doctor. This eventually came from Rodney Clough, who was involved with him. He said, we have since learned that Hank, while in the Hollow Earth, fell in love with a Hollow Earth girl, whom he said was a very beautiful woman. In fact, Hank said that the women of the Hollow Earth are so beautiful that any single man could not help but fall in love with them. He wanted to marry her, but decided he wanted to go back to the surface world to get his tuxedo.
Oh, come on.
It just says he wanted to go back to get his belongings. But you can picture the situation. He's fallen in love with this beautiful inner earth girl. You know, just like the total package, right? She's smart. She's funny. She's beautiful. They organize the wedding and he realizes he's got nothing to wear.
Surely if they've got an escalator that travels at the speed of light, they would have some type of clothing that would suit him.
No, he wants to get his surface tuxedo. So he goes back and he tells his Hopi friend that when he returns to the Grand Canyon, well, his Hopi friend tells him when you return in your tuxedo and you've got everything, you've got your cologne, you've got the ring, you're all ready to go for the wedding, call out my name three times and I'll come and meet you and we'll go back down so you can get married. And according to the story, when Hank returned, he's in his tux, he's all ready to go. He calls out his friend's name three times. Nothing. No reply. He tried for days and nights. He sat there out in his lonely tuxedo.
Al Chiringa! Yeah,
calling to Kapavi to come and collect him. When really he knew that Kapavi had stolen his bride. I mean, think about it. He doesn't say that.
Yeah.
But what else would have happened?
He cut his subterranean grass.
Kapavi's back there banging the Hollow Earth girl, going, oh, it's so sad that the good doctor died in that horrible Grand Canyon accident. We'll never know what happened to him.
There's never any truthfulness or honesty in any of these people, is there?
So according to the story, Hank, the good doctor Hank, he was so disappointed that his friend could never return, he could never return to his fiancée in the inner earth, that he didn't marry until his 70s. He retired, he moved to the Philippines and passed away in March of 2010. And I did a bit of searching today and I did actually find the obituary of this guy. So I know, I'm pretty sure it's the same guy because all the details match up, the age matches up.
How old was he when he died?
Well, he must have been mid to late 70s. I can't remember the details.
So he didn't marry until his 70s and then he drops dead on his wife a few years later.
Well, in the obituary, it says survived by the children of his wife. It doesn't say survived by his children. So it kind of matches up with the story, this obituary I found. But why would he go to the Philippines?
It's cheaper than the Western world?
Wrong. The doctor was looking for Yamashita's gold.
Why in the Philippines?
Why are you looking at me like you don't know the story of Yamashita's gold? Now I've got to tell the story of Yamashita's gold.
No idea what you're talking
about. This is too many doubloon stories for one show.
It is. Maybe we'll move it into plus. Oh, could you fit it in?
I'll just quickly wrap. So end of World War II, okay? American troops are closing in on General Tomoyuki Yamashita for the Japanese Imperial Army.
Mm.
And meanwhile, Yamashita is in the Philippines digging out this huge tunnel complex, and inside the tunnel are treasures of a staggering proportion. This is labeled Tunnel 8, where they are. It's just one of 175 tunnels that the Japanese have dug out across the occupied islands of the Philippines. Each tunnel is filled with billions of dollars of gold, jewels, priceless statues, and art. Now, that Japanese army, as we know from the history of the war, had spent the previous 8 years rampaging through Asia, plundering China, plundering Manchuria, Korea, Malaysia and Indonesia, stripping all these countries of their wealth and systematically moving it to the Philippines. See, this was a plan put forward by Prince Takeda of the Japanese royal family. He had devised this engineering plan to build these tunnels to hide the treasure. They called this Operation Golden Lily. Each site was carefully constructed using a host of specialist engineers, along with enslaved Filipinos and allied prisoners of war. But that night, Takeda took all of his 175 staff into a bunker in Tunnel 8, and they were celebrating that they'd finally completed their task. And as everyone got drunk on sake, and there was a lot of joy and cheer, Prince Takeda and Yamashita quietly slipped away, then blasted the tunnel entrance and sealed the men in.
So that they can't tell anyone.
This was the only way to keep the story of the gold secret. So all those POWs, all those Japanese soldiers, all those engineers, they were all sealed in those tunnels in the Philippines.
You know what? I mean, as awful as that sounds, like, that's terrible. I'm not surprised if they did that back
Smart.
Then.
Smart. I mean, if you and I knew about an ancient treasure, I would definitely bury you in there.
Oh, I would dynamite you in an instant. It wouldn't be a problem.
I mean, I'd leave at least a week's supply of food.
I'll give you a few days. That's all you need.
So Prince Takeda, he flees back to Japan in a submarine. But Yamashita takes what's left of his army north and basically goes on fighting the American opposition. But he surrenders on September the 2nd. Now, American intelligence, they knew that the Japanese were doing this. Undercover operatives had tracked boats disguised as hospital ships to the Philippines and watched as the treasure was being unloaded. So they knew that the treasure was in the Philippines, but they didn't know where the Japanese had hidden it. Now, there's a very long story, which I might save for a future show, because this is a wild, insane conspiracy that, again, involves the CIA, involves government knowledge of this treasure. A young American captain named Edward Lansdale and an American Filipino torture specialist actually found Yamashita's personal driver, and they managed to get out of him the location of 12 of these vaults that the Japanese had buried in the Philippines. And the Americans found them. Row after row of gold bars piled head high. Tons of platinum, ceramic jars full of jewels and diamonds, solid gold Buddhas, priceless artwork, billions of dollars. Billions of dollars.
Hundreds of billions by the sounds of it.
Yeah, well, word got back to MacArthur and President Truman, and they had to make a decision. Do we repatriate these treasures? Do we give it back to the countries that it was taken from?
Of course they don't. No. Of course they don't.
Truman's allegedly, from the report, said, lol.
That's actually a declassified files.
Because, I mean, the logistics of figuring out where it came from,
who owns it.
It's easier if we just keep it for America, right?
Yeah.
And the other problem was, if all these precious metals went back onto the market in 1945, it would have crashed the price of gold.
Yep.
And remember, back then, all the currencies were pegged to gold. So Truman knew this would be an economic bloodbath if all this gold got out.
Pretty good excuse, though, when you want to hang on to all that gold.
Well, the Golden Lily treasure could afford the US incredible power in the Cold War. This is the thing. Like the gold that was taken from the peak in New Mexico, this was used as a slush fund that could then manipulate governments around the world. It could buy elections. You could bankroll near limitless black operations, including reverse engineering light speed escalators.
Which are now used underneath the continent, all across America.
I think I've seen one of those in a supermarket in China.
Yeah.
100 people gets on and just goes...
Not built very well, unfortunately.
You've seen that video,
Oh,
right?
I have, yeah.
So this is a story to be continued on a future show. There is a couple of books that have been published. One is from Sterling Seagrave, entitled Gold Warriors, America's Secret Recovery of Yamashita's Gold. Apparently there is a paper trail. This is a true story, and you can find evidence of the Americans finding this huge treasure trove and using it for black ops projects. The only other update I have from this is from the Daily Mail in January this year. Typical Daily Mail headline fashion. Let me read this to you. Has the secret treasure stolen by a Japanese World War II general been uncovered in the Philippines? Adventurers claim gold bars have been found in a booby-trapped cave. And I'll link to this in the show notes, but there is this video that emerged earlier this year of a bunch of divers in the Philippines pulling cases out of this filthy cave. And you can see one of them using a tool to brush the dust off these, or the grime off these large block type bricks, and underneath is what looks like solid gold.
Why were they dumb enough to tell the Daily Mail?
And that's the thing. And then they put it on YouTube. So that's
ultimate. We do live in a different world now, though. A very different world. And I guess if you did have just a couple of divers or whatever else that found something, maybe they would just chuck it on YouTube. People do stupid things these
days.
That
is so dumb.
Oh, I know, but people are dumb these days.
That is so dumb.
I don't know.
I'm not going to even tell anyone when my Bitcoin goes back to the moon.
It's like the idiot that won Big Brother here. You know what he did? He posted up his bank balance, a screenshot of his bank balance, which included all of his details, including account numbers and balances and everything. Idiot. Yeah.
That's what you do when you win the lottery. The first thing you do is announce it on Facebook.
To everyone.
The second thing you do is go and buy the most expensive car you can afford, and then you buy your mom a house. That's the ultimate lottery strategy.
No, you hire a lawyer and you disappear. Yeah. Listen to me. If you ever win the lottery, hire a lawyer, don't tell anyone, and disappear. Because people that you were in high school with, that you accidentally said something mean to them, will come hunting for you.
Yeah.
That's what happens.
That's what will happen one day when you visit mysteriousuniverse.org and it's just a 404. That's when you know that one of us won the lottery.
I dream of that day.
Yeah, we have a pact, right? If you win, I'll give you, you give me some money.
Yep.
And if I win, you give me some money.
Yep. And screw Mysterious Universe. Why am I so excited about that?
I would at least leave a message.
No message. I told you, don't tell anyone. So we'll just go.
Just a back in 5 minutes note on the door. Just never seen again. But that would become its own conspiracy.
I'd like to burn the studio down.
If we disappeared, imagine the stories that would spin out of that. We could leave little clues behind.
Yeah, that's a great idea.
Like a little just a random blood stain in your office.
Yeah. Splatter up the wall.
Splash of semen in mine.
Oh, God. What the hell went on there?
We'll just leave a severed monkey's hand in the studio. Imagine the conspiracy.
The really scary part is the fact that you already know that means that you've thought about this. Yeah.
And we'll hide a couple of doubloons around.
Yeah, just scatter coins around. Be fine.
I'll link to all that stuff in the show notes. The books from David Hatcher Childress are really fun. Lost Cities and Ancient Mysteries of the Southwest. And also, I want you to check out Underground Alien Bases from Commander X. If you're into fun stories that have absolutely zero factual basis to them, those Commander X books are pretty fun.
They're amazing.
I mean, they're just full of, you know, escalator, light speed escalator stories.
I still don't see the point. Why you'd want an escalator traveling at the speed of, I mean, maybe it's
because it's so deep in the ground that if you, this is hard to understand.
Do you realize, right?
It's like, do you want to walk to Melbourne? It'll take you months.
No, but you can't even travel at light speed on Earth, because if you'd end up on the opposite side of the planet.
If you've got a bubble dampener, you can.
Okay, we'll leave that for another show. We'll work it out another time.
Yeah. What's coming up in the Plus extension?
Well, as I said, we're going to be going into some very strange ghost stories that were uncovered by Elliot O'Donnell, who is really a fascinating man. I didn't know about him before, but he's just published all these really obscure ghost hunting books. He was like the first great ghost hunter. He was born in the late 1800s, and he ended up across the UK and across America. And the reason why I haven't covered him in the past is because some of his books I found were things like The Haunted Screaming Skulls. And I've gone, oh, that's too skeleton style. And I went, no, I'm not going to cover that. But I'm really pleased I did, because Nick Redfern pointed me in the direction of this strange story of a spectral ape, which just led me down the path of all these strange encounters that people have had with, I wouldn't even say residual hauntings. They're definitely entities that are harassing people. And it lines up very nicely with our previous Plus show. Remember the woman who saw that strange orb that was moving around those ancient megaliths and it turned into a massive worm?
Yeah, you told that story recently.
I've got stories that kind of line up with that a little bit and demonstrate that there may be guardians to certain sites, megalithic sites, not just in the UK, but all around the world.
And the children that encountered the wolf bear dog.
Dog. Bad.
The dog. Wolf bear.
Whatever, it's interchangeable, but yes.
Do they survive the encounter?
We'll have to join Plus to find out.
That's the ultimate teaser, really. If you're going to have dead kids at the end of the show or not.
Yep. I mean, God, if I could fit more dead kids into Plus, it's a good show.
That's a wrap for this edition of MU. Thanks for listening. If you want to get access to Plus, head to mysteriousuniverse.org/plus. All the details are there. You get the big extensions on the end of these shows every single Friday, and you get exclusive shows every single Tuesday as well. In addition to that, you get a higher bitrate feed, a wonderful 320 kilobits per second version of the show. All the ads are stripped out for Plus members. Your experience is ad-free, and you get a massive discount on our back catalogue as well. On your dashboard, there's a 50% off coupon code, so you can check out some of our older shows. All the features of our apps are unlocked as well for Plus members. Again, make sure you check it out. It's the best way to keep us going and support this show. Mysterious
lottery.
Until that day. Unless Bitcoin goes to 100 grand.
Oh, that's good as well. Yeah. Either way.
It's never going to go that far. Again, mysteriousuniverse.org/plus. Support the show. Check it out. And that's a wrap. Mysteriousuniverse.org. Look for season... What are we up to?
Season 18, episode 11.
All the show notes will be there as well, and links to everything we've spoken about today. If you're on Plus, stick around for the awesome stuff after the break. For everyone else, thanks for listening. We'll catch you next week. Welcome back for your Plus extension. Great to have you with us. Looking forward to juicy tales of wolf, bear, dog, emus.
You're making it bigger than it actually is. I mean, that's only a very small segment out of the overall segment that I have coming up.